Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Josh, what's your favorite AudioSlave song?
To everyone listening, the reason that this podcast has gone out in two parts, it's not, but this is the narrative I'm spinning, is because we got so busy and sidetracked in the office because Scott Tilford was introducing me to AudioSlave. And who's the other one? Soundgarden.
Who's the other one?
Soundgarden. Never heard of them before.
Man hadn't heard of Chris Cornell, so I had to do a round trip of AudioSlave and Soundgarden. I mean, anyone in my, you know, so let's say a few meter radius should be aware of Chris Cornell, AudioSlave and Soundgarden.
Normally when you bring up one of these bands, like, because I used to rinse the music channels way back in the day, like the rock music channels. So I at least kind of like know a song or a chorus or a video.
Yeah.
With these two bands, I was just sat there like, how have I got this massive blind spot?
If you were a frequenter of Kerrang or Scuzz or whatever across the early 2000s, I cannot believe you didn't know AudioSlave's Kashis video.
Well, there was some, like, the harder bands, I sometimes would, like, just turn off. I told you that, like, I never got into, like, Korn and whatnot. I was more pop punk, you know what I mean?
I was more into,
like, The Offspring was, like, as hard as I got in terms of that period. And then Slipknot, other times,
not for me.
Certainly not for me back then. I've come to appreciate Slipknot and, like, Bring Me the Horizon now. But I was a snotty, bloody Green Day, Blink-182, Weezer fan, so...
Oh, Weezer
missed
fan.
Everything else. Big Weezer fan.
Oh, Weezer, I saw Weezer live. This is not a music podcast, although if we ever resurrect the What Culture Music channel, we'll do the same thing.
Absolutely, and to be fair, for the start, it is because the reason that we're splitting today's podcast into two is because, once again, I'm missing a Monday, because this Sunday I'm going to London to see Lana Del Rey, and I can't get back in time for the podcast, so
it's
hopefully...
It's not AudioSlave, is it?
It's not AudioSlave, no. So we're going to film... Well, we're going to record the two parts of this podcast, the first half today and the second half, hopefully, tomorrow. So we won't miss a day.
No, everything will make sense in terms of the way that things regularly roll out. We're going to do the greatest games of all time, according to Scott and Josh, and we'll just see what this is. This is entirely subjective ranking. I have no idea what yours is. We're going to do 10 till 6 on this week's show, and we'll do 5 to 1 next week, and we'll just see how it goes. I just shot from the hip with this.
You just did.
With what comes to mind when I think of this, because if it's that good, it'll be on my mind anyway.
You almost didn't come in with even a list sketched out, which kind of blew my mind, but I appreciate it because, like you said before we started recording, if it doesn't immediately come to mind, is it worthy of being on the top 10? I wanted to do this podcast, I must admit, because I was trying to force you into it, Scott. Yes. I was like, please let us do this topic. One, because we've never actually done this before. We've sometimes done a chatty face or something, or we've mentioned in passing what might be in our top five. What is our favorite game of all time? But I realized over the weekend, I've never sat down and actually sketched out, if someone came to me and said, what are your favorite 10 favorite games of all time?
Right.
I would probably know the first three, and they were what ended up being my top three. Mm-hmm. But after that, there's so many games. I'm not sure if you know this. There's so many good games that have released over the decades we've been alive that, I don't know, it gave me a nice thing to do on a Monday morning.
Yeah, man. Well, I think for me, it's always like, obviously, me and you, we did a whole podcast once on the whole objectivity, subjectivity, the approach to reviews, the approach to whether a game is actually good or whether do you actually like it. I mean, the case in point, and it's not on my top 10 games of the year, like all games of all time list, is the new AEW game, something that is largely on fire, but I'm having a lot of fun with it. It's not objectively good, but subjectively, I'm liking it.
Yeah.
Which is to say that when we do the greatest games of all time, they are according to each of us. And we'll just break these things down. Like I said, my criteria initially was what comes to mind, and then I went back on some older articles that I've done, because I'm a dinosaur, and I've written a lot of stuff in 10 years of doing this for What Culture. So I went back on some of our old best games of the 90s, best games of the 2000s, best games of the 2010s that were all written by me. And just, is anything on there that I missed? No. Most of the stuff was just what my mind conjured up anyway.
Yeah.
So, with that in mind, my number 10 greatest game of all time, personally, is Assassin's Creed 2.
Whoa!
Yeah,
I was so... Ah, this is why I'm so pleased you started with this. Because I was really wondering, I was trying to think of the games that you mentioned previously, and I know you're a huge fan of those early Assassin's Creed games, but I was wondering, in 2023, does Scott Telford still consider
those...
Does he consider them still one of the greatest of all time? So please tell me why Assassin's Creed 2 has made this list.
They'll never get it back. Ubisoft will never get it back, what it felt like, that original rollout of Assassin's Creed, from the original trailers before the first game, when they just showed all the stuff with who would later become Altair, walking through the environments with the hidden blade, and everyone was like, what the hell is this game? And there are different glitches and visual stuff in the trailer. It's like, something else seems to be going on. And they were... all the sci-fi stuff, all the modern-day stuff was barely shown beforehand, and they played their hand so masterfully. I love that original game. I love the reveals of Subject 16, and I love the way that it ends. All the stuff with, like, all the eagle vision, all the different scrollings on the wall, realizing that, like, oh, we're building to, like, you know, this idea of a modern-day assassin learning from the past, and all the different ways the Animus works, and just all the rules of that world that were coming together at the very beginning, because they had Patrice Desilet leading the whole thing. They had, like, a overarching vision. I think at the time it was for 5 games, maybe 6, and that was what they were going for. And so at the end of Assassin's Creed 1, I loved that game, and everything just was perfectly building to the next one. And then you get Assassin's Creed 2, which perfectly built on the gameplay side of things, fleshed out all the different moves that you had. You could disarm people, you could fight unarmed if you wanted. I thought the combat just picked up beautifully, and like I said, the story just built on it. Exactly what I want. I'm the guy who loves Lost and loves Metal Gear and loves a big, stupid, convoluted lore that I can still follow. That's why I'm not a big Kingdom Hearts fan. I need to be able to follow it. And so, like, it's one of those things where Assassin's Creed was, like, laying the table just so well. And it's hard to, you know, remember that now, because it's such a bloated, over-the-top thing. We just did a news on how Ubisoft have 11 games in production right now for Assassin's Creed. But it was, like, it was just that game that, like, perfectly played out, and it has one of the best endings ever, personally, I think. The whole reveal of Minerva, and she's talking to Desmond, but she's talking to Ezio, but she's actually talking to Desmond through time. The whole sort of reveal with that. I know fans don't know what I mean, but there's, like, a whole reveal with the character, which just directly addresses what a lot of fans at the time thought was happening. And it was just that whole thing of that cut to black, to me, is iconic AF, and having Desmond say "what the F" straight after that, as I said it as child me, teenage me. You're never going to get better than that. That was the absolute apex of that franchise. Even though I think Brotherhood plays better, 2 has way better story.
You've answered my question before. Gosh. I was going to go into my gushing thoughts about Assassin's Creed 2. I was going to ask you what makes this above Brotherhood, which, if I was doing a list of my favorite Assassin's Creed, I would probably have higher than 2 because of those gameplay improvements that
Brotherhood
you mentioned
does
there.
Play better,
is it just the kind of, like you said, the story and the monumental feeling of AC2 that kind of
they paid off all the mystery from 1 perfectly, and it was just it felt like there's so few things, be it TV, movie, or game, can take you on that mystery, what's really happening ride. And even rarer are at the end of that, if it's actually satisfying. And being in the middle of, like, you know, something that was kicking off in terms of, like, what are we going for? How does the ancient world, all these different gods that they're teasing, and all these different lore aspects, and the Animus and Abstergo and all that kind of stuff. And I just felt like this was the perfect continuation of that. It was just such a propellant sequel that I absolutely loved it. And because it played so well, I just rocketed through it. And it's the ending. I never really liked Brotherhood's ending. I just thought it was a bit cheap.
Right.
The whole thing with, like, possessing Lucy and having the whole stab thing and whatever. It did very little for me. I think they brought it back in Revelations, where they had the whole thing with Ezio and Altair, and like tales told over time. But there's something about that original propellant feeling of Assassin's Creed where it was like, this is the new IP.
Yeah.
And they played it all so well.
Yeah, they did, man. Like, Assassin's Creed 2 dropped with such a thunderous kind of entrance, didn't it? Like, it made waves. It felt monumental. It felt big. I think what people should appreciate more is kind of how much Assassin's Creed 2 felt like a prestige bit of gaming at the time, which might sound weird considering how formulaic the franchise got and how it got annualized and we kind of got these games all the time. But I remember how bold the opening of AC2 felt when you start with a younger Ezio and you kind of go through that lengthy introduction and kind of, like, grow up with him. I remember at the time being maybe a bit too young for it and being like, come on, I want to get to the assassining stuff. I don't want this. But at the time, it just felt like, no, we're telling a story. We're being methodical in our approach. We're going to take as much time as we need to start with to introduce you to this world and these characters. And ultimately, that paid off because we're how many games away from the Ezio trilogy? And we still talk about Ezio and those characters in that setting all the time. You know, they remastered them. That still held up as like the pinnacle of the Assassin's Creed franchise so far, and kind of for good reason.
Totally, man. It's just, they, like I said, they built on all this stuff gameplay-wise, but it was a sense of place, and it was like freeing up a lot of the explorative systems. Like the parkour was like expanded on quite a lot. Ezio was a great character. The different costumes you get for him are awesome.
Yeah.
It was just like, and then looking after Monteriggioni was really cool, and it was just like, it just had everything. AC2 is by far my personal favorite game, even though, like you said, if I had to sort of rank them more objectively or whatever, Brotherhood does play better because of all the summoning the assassins and planning all that stuff out. I just wasn't as satisfied by the story side of things. And the more you look into the behind the scenes stuff, that was when Patrice Desilet started to sort of step away, because their original plan for, like I said, it was either 5 or 6 games, started to very much be scuppered, because it was like, whoever within Ubisoft was like, this is making a lot of money, we need to stretch this thing out.
Yeah.
And I think his last game became AC3, that he left halfway through development. And you can really tell. So, yeah.
I have such a weird relationship with those early Assassin's Creed games because they have such a place in my heart. I loved them enough to make a ritual out of them. So, from Assassin's Creed 2 onwards, up until Assassin's Creed Black Flag, which is the first one I didn't get, I would get them every Christmas. So that's like 4 years of my life where I got an Assassin's Creed every Christmas.
Nice.
And that was my Christmas ritual. You know, I would open it, I would go upstairs, I'd play it until lunch was ready or whatever it was. Yet, even back then, I remember thinking like, the gameplay never quite did it for me. Like, the mechanics never fully clicked, but it still, like you said, it had that something. It still had that draw. It it wanted you to play it. It wanted you to experience this world. It wanted you to experience those characters. And even though it wouldn't crack my top 10 list, like, everyone who played Assassin's Creed 2, everyone who played Assassin's Creed Brotherhood, just kind of, I think, has fond memories of it. I've never met someone who said, nah, it's crap.
The thing is, like, for me, it's perfectly part of that sort of, like, mid-2000s, like, the emergence of fan theories as a wider discourse, the emergence of, like, broadband connections and the ability to bring more people together and for people to theorize on things and what's going to happen. And like I said, I was there for Assassin's Creed from the very first teaser. That Wood Kid song that is on the trailer, like, it's awesome. And I remember all that stuff. And it's like, I was, like I said, I was a huge Lost fan. I was a huge Cloverfield fan. Like, I was that guy getting lost in, like, oh my god, what's really going on type stuff. And so Assassin's Creed did the same thing, where it was like, oh, we're tapping into all these different historical images and we're placing pieces of Eden in them to try and like pretend that like it was always connected from the beginning, and what's really going on with the history of humanity and all that kind of stuff.
Hey,
and teenage me lapped that up.
You mentioned trailers there. Yeah. How good were the Assassin's Creed trailers in that period?
So stylish.
They were so stylish. They were so grand. They I want to play that game almost. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, the games that they promised in those trailers are so bloody sick, with so much personality and so much style. And of course, a lot of that trickled down to the games themselves. But that was when the franchise was just firing on all cylinders.
The thing is, like,
you must play this game. He is the game. He's the trailers. Look how confident it is. We know what this thing is.
That's the thing. And I feel like it's because that original template for the IP was so, so, so strong that they've been able to maintain it for this long. And they have so many games in production and whatever. But yeah, for me, they'll never recapture what it felt like to go through that original set of games. I was going to say trilogy, but it's more AC1, 2, Brotherhood and Revelations. Revelations was weaker gameplay-wise, but nailed it on the story.
Yeah.
And then AC3, for me, was where it started to get a bit shaky, even though I think that game plays really well.
Looks great as well, still.
Yeah, totally. I bought the remaster and stuff, and it's like, yeah, it's just one of those things where AC used to mean so much to me, and I used to just follow every single bit of the lore, the plot, and all that kind of stuff, and it was like one of those instances where like the actual creators cared less about it than the fans did, and it was interesting watching that all play out. But what's your number 10?
My number 10, and this is the only one that I want to add a caveat to and preface it by saying, people might think less of me when I say what my number 10 is, but I hope I can give you an argument as to why it deserves a place on my personal top 10.
It's your personal
saying thing. It's the 10th best game of all time, but at number 10, I have Call of Duty Warzone, the original Call of Duty Warzone.
Okay. World at War? Is it Warzone?
The Battle Royale.
Right, got you.
Free-to-play game that dropped in March 2020. Now, Scott Taylor, I'm not sure what you were doing in March 2020, but a big thing happened in the world.
It did a bit.
The pandemic might have hit and trapped us all inside, scared out of our wits for a little bit. And I was a huge fan of Call of Duty 2019. And this to me, felt like the next evolution of Call of Duty generally. Mm. Like, as you know, we've talked about it so many times, couldn't get into Battle Royale games for the life of me. I tried so many times playing PUBG, playing Fortnite, playing H1Z1, and I just could never get away with it. I even played Call of Duty Blackout, I think it was called, which was the Battle Royale mode for Call of Duty Black Ops 3, or maybe probably 4, actually.
Right.
And I just could never get into that either, so I thought this genre is dead to me. It's not for me.
That's what I was saying in March 2020. I was like, this is not for me.
Yeah, absolutely, right? And now, here it is. I've got a Battle Royale game at number 10 on my list because Call of Duty Warzone gave me the immediacy of Call of Duty gameplay and polish and pristineness onto a multiplayer framework that I just find absolutely incredible. Mm. No two matches play the same. You know, every single thing in those matches feels dynamic. There's an element of teamwork and tactical thinking required to get through a game of any Battle Royale. And when you add friends into the mix, it just elevated the multiplayer experience. By this point, I was so sick of Deathmatch. I'd played Deathmatch for 10 years of my life, hundreds and thousands of hours into regular deathmatch and, you know, domination style modes, and I needed something else. I needed that dynamic nature back. I needed a sense of scale that I hadn't seen, and Call of Duty Warzone delivered it. But if I'm being honest, the reason it's on here is because of the pandemic. This, I have so many fond memories from that horrible period where I'd get quote-unquote home from a day of work, which was literally moving around my one-bedroom flat from my desk in the corner to my couch, which was less than a foot away, plonking myself down, getting a bit of, you know, social time with my friends, playing Call of Duty Warzone every night for 5 or 6 hours, getting really invested in the meta, getting really invested in the progression, and it had the foundation to kind of back that up from a gameplayer perspective. And it's just a shame that as of last week, I think, they announced that the original version of Call of Duty Warzone is getting taken off.
Oh.
And no one will be able to experience what I experienced again. Like, that has been removed. You can't play that version of it. The map isn't there anymore. And I think, what a weird thing to have this, my 10th best, most favorite game of all time, exist for 3 years and then disappear. It's so weird.
The thing is that with the pandemic, like, it is weird to be like, oh, it's the best game because of the pandemic. But those unique circumstances did reinforce certain gameplay tropes or gameplay tendencies or whatever. Like, I played Spiritfarer. That was my pandemic game for the first few months of the pandemic, which is like a mix of like a sort of narratively infused farming game. And I just like lived on that for like 2 or 3 months. And that game has an extremely special place in my heart because of the way the story plays out, that I thought was just like phenomenal. But I think that, yeah, if you're talking subjective rankings, then that can just bolster it. Like, there was something about getting lost in something familiar that also felt new. Plus, Warzone played better than like anything else. So why not?
And you know what? Honestly, if Warzone wasn't in here, I think another Call of Duty game would be in there because Call of Duty's multiplayer, I think everyone has their multiplayer experience that they gravitate towards. Mm. That might be Halo, that might be Gears.
It might be Halo, Josh.
It might be, yeah, I'm sure it is, right? It might be Counter-Strike, it might be Rainbow Six, whatever. Mm. To me, it was Call of Duty's multiplayer. Mm. Call of Duty 4 could have been on here. Modern Warfare 2 could have been on here. Modern Warfare 2019 could have been on here because it's kind of reflective of the multiplayer games that I lost myself with, and Warzone just is up there because it's the game I put the most hours into. I played over 500 hours of Warzone, which is the most I've played any game by far.
I remember your end of year card thing just being dominated by Call of Duty.
Literally, man. And I was so, like I said, I was so invested in the mechanics that it managed to support, you know, the amount of time we were putting into it, and having that time and having nothing else to do, and like I said, getting that bit of socialization from your friends, it was a horrible like recipe, but it was a recipe, it was a tonic that was needed for that period. And you know, like, I won't take many good things away from the pandemic, but that is absolutely one I will take away from. Take away from it.
That and Animal Crossing as another one, where I feel like a lot of people just dove on Animal Crossing for a bit. My number 9 is The Elder Scrolls 5 Skyrim. Getting the big boys on the go. This is one of those games that just, I mean, everyone's played Skyrim. I'm not going to recant what that is, but I just feel like, you know, it's 12 years now since Skyrim first came out. And it just was that monumental a release. If you were there at the time, you know what it felt like. It was one of those games that I remember. I was in the middle of doing my dissertation at the time for, I think, my master's at university, and I like it was dropping. It was a big deal. We'd all seen the trailer. We'd all seen the trailers. Played Oblivion and everything. And I was like, I can't touch it because if I do, I'll not finish my dissertation. I was like, but I ended up buying it anyway and putting it on my table, but I left it in this sort of wrapping, like the cellophane wrapping the stuff. And I stood it up, so it was looking at me. And I was like, okay, I'll get to you in 12,000 words time. And I didn't. I did it about halfway through. I was like, I'm going to have to do a little bit. I mean, it's been sat there all day.
Yeah.
And so just playing that game. And I just, it was one of those games that it's one of my favorite energies in gaming when everybody's playing something. We had it last year with Elden Ring. And it seldom happens these days because there's not that many titles that everybody's interested in that everybody then picks up on day one, whether that be a price reason or whatever it is because it's broken AF. But in Skyrim's case, even the bugs that it did have didn't matter. There was back when Bethesda could get away with that stuff.
Yeah.
With the giants launching people across the map and everything. It was just charming. It was just fun because the vast majority worked. And it was just everyone sharing their builds, sharing what they found, sharing the different approaches they had to the story. Everybody largely ignoring the story, but I loved that stuff. I love all the stuff with the Greybeards and all the stuff with Parthenax and everything. And it was just a cool game, just a really great game, kind of tied in with the beginning of Game of Thrones when a lot of that more sort of icy medieval aesthetic was doing the rounds, and I feel like Skyrim tapped into that quite nicely. And it was just one of those things where it was, to me, again, kind of like with Assassin's Creed to Ubisoft, I wonder if Bethesda will ever get this again. Mm. Skyrim felt like a really big mainstream moment for them in a way that Oblivion and Morrowind and previous never did. And I don't think they'll get it with Elder Scrolls 6. I just think it was such a point in time. Now, we're talking about where the open world genre was at in 2011, before the checkbox era of like Far Cry 3 or whatever onwards. And it was just such a perfectly made thing. So I've used the word perfect a lot, but I do view these games as exactly what they set out to be.
Top 10 of all time, man. Yeah. They've got to be perfect to get on this list. Skyrim isn't on mine, but it would have made it in my top 20 for all of the reasons you just mentioned there. Mm-hmm. At the time, This was the game I was most excited for in my life. I was a huge, huge fan of Oblivion. That was the game that introduced me to RPGs in general and what an open world RPG could be. Mm-hmm. I loved Fallout 3 even more. So going into this, the hype was astronomical. And it's managed to exceed my expectations, even though they were stratospheric in the first place. Mm-hmm. I just think the evolution that happened between even Fallout 3 and Skyrim was huge. Yeah, it was running on the same engine. Yeah, it still had that jankiness. But the way they tightened up their game design, for me, was amazing. Even something as simple now is having each dungeon end with a treasure chest that like kind of wraps up your experience there, makes you realize, okay, this is finished, I can move on. Like when you were doing that in Oblivion or even Fallout 3, you would maybe sometimes get lost, you were kind of backtracking yourself, it was a bit confusing, it was like, well, have I done everything here? It just made everything a little bit neater while expanding the scope. Like the introduction of dragons at the time felt so big and cool.
Like
and
fighting them on the side of a mountain.
Yeah,
like
being able to fight them, like you said, for me, the kind of the Norse-inspired setting, you know, the kind of the horned armor that you would have. Like, yeah, the Dovahkiin, the icier setting was, for me, preferable to what I got in Oblivion.
Same.
And it's kind of weird singing the praises of Skyrim after, like you said, you know, so many people have played it. It's such this cultural touchstone. Mm-hmm. But, like, I think it was huge for a reason. It's played today for a reason. And I wish I'd played it more because I hammered it across 2011 and 12 and a bit of 13. Right. But I've not really gone back to it for a decade, man.
I feel like I go back to it like every year. Like I've got it on every single system I own, including the Switch. Like it's just one of those games that I'll just go back to. It's like comfort food. Like I play the most of it in 2011 and finished the campaign. But I love spending my time in it. I love making a new build, or I love picking a new character and just wandering around for a bit. One small thing I want to shout out for this game is like even the elements of style that you get in the combat, like the finishing cams. Like I always remember playing, when I first started playing, I played as like an archer, and there was like this one bit near the beginning. It's like near Winterfell, or whatever you call the first area, Winterhold. It's something like that because the other ones in Game of Thrones.
Yes.
Some winter place. And there's a couple of towers with a bridge in the middle, and there's an archer shooting you from the middle. And I remember just aiming skyward and just hoping for the best.
Yeah.
And as I let go of the button to put the kill cam on, and I saw the arrow fly all the way along and take the guy out, and I was like, this is absolutely phenomenal.
Yes.
Gaming is not going to get better than this. And I love little inserts of like style in video games. They've gone away as the Matrix's influence on entertainment has like faded, but I love slow-mo. I love 360 cams. I love like following a bullet or an arrow to a face. I love that stuff.
It was something they didn't really have to do because Fallout 3 obviously had VATS, which gave you like a little bit of slow motion, and it would pull out and show you some brutal headshots in like 360 slow-mo. But like they could have just done similar to Oblivion again, but in overhauling the actual combat and making it a little bit more weighty, not massively weighty, but a little bit more weighty and giving it that style, just made it feel like a proper big jump, a proper sequel. And honestly, man, I feel like the reason that I haven't gone back to it as much as you is because I view that first playthrough as so perfect. I'll always remember discovering a new city for the first time, because every time I went to a new city and did the quests there, it was like a big milestone in my playthrough. I wouldn't see a new one for like 10 or 15 hours, and then I'd say, okay, I've explored this area, I'm ready to move on and progress.
So much
this
in
journey.
Each one as well.
And there's so much in each one. Each one looks different, like they have their own personality, their own distinct sense of place, and getting to them felt like such a big thing that I just can't replicate it. It's one of the few games on my list that if I could wipe my brain and play it again, I would. Because
see, for me, it's
back.
Like, I definitely back that, and the first playthrough was the most, like, individually iconic, or whatever you want to call it, the one that stayed with me the most. But because of that, it's like going back in and be like, oh my God, how did they make this much stuff? How does everything feel handcrafted? How is there this much dialogue in it? And these many different ways to play it, and different ways that all the NPCs bounce off you and everything else. Like, that thing is a miracle. Like, especially now, when the amount of games that come out that are broken now, and then, like, to me, Bethesda have never followed up on that feeling since 2011 for me personally. It's all the more impressive if you do go back to it now. Your number nine, sir.
My number nine is Disco Elysium.
What a beautiful pick.
Oh, another game, funnily enough, that I had huge expectations for. Obviously, it dropped on PC first. We had to wait a little while to get it on PlayStation, and I'd heard everyone talking about this is, you know, one of the best written games ever. It's one of the best RPGs you'll ever play. But while I was expecting to love the writing, that kind of isometric RPG style has never really done it for me. So there was no guarantee that I would like this game from a mechanical standpoint, especially when it's going to be like 30, 40, maybe even 50 hours of this isometric kind of adventure game style gameplay. But I did, and it's great because this has one of the best worlds and one of the best, I think, main characters of all time Harry Dubois.
Easily.
Which is impressive because your Harry will be different from my Harry. There are so many different avenues.
Ours was so different, it was hilarious.
So different. So many different ways you can customize this nightmare of a character by indulging in the different, how would you even describe them as, emotions going on within him. So if you don't know what Disco Elysium is, you play as this drunken nightmare cop who wakes up hungover, has no idea who he even is, has no idea what his case is. How he even thinks, and he has to solve a murder that's happening in this town. But the way the game handles its role-playing decisions is that it has a bunch of different impulses in Harry's brain that are vying to kind of control him. So you have, you know, you have anger, you have guilt, you have all of these other warring emotions. And every time you have to make a decision, all of these different voices in Harry's head will pop up and try to sway you to their side. And each one is piss funny. Each one is so tightly written that no matter how you construct your character, you're always going to have a good time. And the way that the narrative branches off from that is fascinating. You can do different parts of the game in completely different orders. You can meet characters. You can have relationships with characters that other people might not have because you've made a wrong decision or you've chosen poorly. And it's just one of those games that's so full of personality, so funny, while still having this rich and complex lore and history and story to it that, you know, you could play the game forever and probably still find new things and new interpretations and whatnot.
That was one of those games that, like, kind of like Skyrim, where it's just like if you think of a game as like the design side of it as like a matrix, like the amount of different components, different points that all talk to each other and everything else. Disco Elysium was like endlessly mind-blowing in terms of how many different things it was tracking. And I don't even know how many endings it has, and I kind of don't want to know because it feels, my ending felt completely unique to me.
Yeah.
And I know that there are like massively different ones in terms of how much evidence you find, and there's all sorts of weird little side quests that you can sort of tap into, or side dialogue that you can tap into that also then comes back around at the end, where I was like, oh, they're paying that off, and they're paying that off, and they're paying that off. But yeah, it is one of those games that is almost entirely dialogue driven, minus tiny little bits of like gameplay stuff that you do in terms of picking up different bits of evidence and stuff. But it's just so impressive. Yeah. It just is so rawly impressive. Like, you could give it to anyone, and even from the opening few scenes.
Yes.
You might die, your character might die reaching for the light bulb to get his pants off the top of the light because of the night that he's had before. I die trying to sit down at one point.
Yeah.
Because the chair was uncomfortable and my, it was not even really health, but his disposition thing was so low anyway that the chair just like finished him off. He had like a heart attack or something. So all that stuff I just think is like phenomenal. But like you said, it has this like through line of this like murder mystery thing that has a quite a dark tone to it, but it is really, it's like really darkly funny.
It is.
It's very uniquely written like that.
So darkly funny, like so satirical, so just like, so full of charm. And like you said, even the core story that it's telling is compelling enough on its own. Honestly, even if there wasn't such a heavy emphasis on decision-making, I think if you still told a story, this story with these characters in this world, in this mood, it would still be a contender for one of my favorite games ever made, because it has such a sense of place. And Harry as a character, like I mentioned, has so many layers to them, and uncovering his history is tragic, and it can be heartbreaking while also being funny. Your bloody police partner, who we haven't mentioned, Kim, is also one of the best characters ever made. And just all of the interactions going on, it taps into something really human, I think. And there's a lot of pathos within it. And I think that, you know, I could talk about this game.
Well, the thing is, like, one thing that it made me think of as we're talking about it now, and it is threaded in the game anyway, it's the like the beginning of Fahrenheit or Indigo Prophecy, where it's like that game, one of David Cage's early games, just opens with your character, Lucas Kane, I think he's called, finding a body in a bathroom. And like you know as the audience that you've murdered him, but then it's completely up to you what you do. It's like, do you hide the body? Do you tell someone about it? There's a cop in the diner. Do you try and tell them? Do you make an exit out the back door? It's up to you. And I love that whole, the game, Lucas, loses all that as it plays out. But Disco is quite similar. It's like, how do you want to approach this case? Who do you want to talk to? Who actually seems like a reliable witness? And how do you think? How do you as an individual think? And the game tracks all that stuff. To the point where it was calling me out for being like a dirty centrist, because I was trying to make harmony between different people. And it was like, no. And I love that it works on that sort of Black Mirror level, like what GTA used to do in terms of like, well, how are you approaching these missions? Or how many pedestrians are you killing or whatever?
Right,
and it has that undercurrent of like, the game is also reading you as you sort of like flesh out who Harry was or whatever, you fix all the amnesiac stuff.
That's totally right, man. And I feel like with that, it can tell you a lot about yourself if you do kind of follow what you would do in that situation or an approximation of that. But it also gives it such role-playing potential for multiple playthroughs where you can go through, and if you wanted to be this like a horrible fascist who like makes everything worse and is just an absolute,
I just try to be nice,
train wreck. I'm not saying you did that.
It was funny because like that was what became contrasted with realizing how other people were playing it. I was like, I'm just trying to get on with everybody. Can someone help me solve this murder? I'm literally being the middle centrist guy. And I love that the game just sort of calls you out and says, no, pick a side. You need to find a way through this with some conviction.
Literally. Otherwise, you might try to play both sides, and both sides are like, no. And then you're left trying to figure out this case without any leads or any relationships or whatever. But yeah, man, like, I just have so many memorable moments of trying to get through those missions, because every kind of main action you do is informed by a dice roll, and you can get that percentage on your side by investing in certain skills, but that doesn't give you like a guaranteed path throughout the entire game. So you might have a 98% chance to do something, and this is when the 2% comes up and you fail it. And I liked committing to those actions and not reloading saves, and just kind of accepting that as part of the fun, because like I said, keep saying, Harry is a nightmare. He will get things wrong, and it's fun to react to negative situations and bad outcomes as it is to get through the game in a perfect way and
I think
play
as well,
the game and complete the game. You know?
Yeah, so I think as well, it's like, it's such a good detective game as well, that like, this is a really satisfying story. Like, there are so many components to it. You are unraveling it yourself, but there are main beats to uncover. So I think there is like a certain level of satisfaction you're going to get anyway. It's not like there's too much choice where you can just miss everything. There was a whole sort of bit in the middle chunk of that game, majority of the middle of that game, where everything was just clicking and I couldn't wait to talk to the next character to uncover the next thing. And it was also one of those things that so few games get right that are dialogue driven, where you can your character lets you ask the thing that you want to ask as the audience. They're not deliberately obfuscating information. Like, it feels like you can chase things down, which I just, like, massively loved. My number eight is God of War 2018.
Whoa!
Another meaty boy. Just certain titles that over the years just escalated, like, were just worth more than all their separate parts combined. There was something about God of War that just represented a maturation of gaming, represented a maturation of Sony and Santa Monica, and even Corey Barlog, who was there from the beginning of God of War, went back when it was David Jaffe and everything. Well, he's on God of War 2 anyway. And I just thought that, like, I love the whole idea of maturing legacy characters and, like, where are they at now, and not trying to do things that tap back into, like, not pretending they can still do everything the way that they could, because as we age, we can't. And this, you need to mature, you need to learn, you need to grow as a person. And, like, I just love that they were encapsulating that. And it was like, we got God of War and Uncharted 4 both dealt with the idea of, like, what's Nathan Drake's retirement like? Can he get back out there and do it again? What's his, where does that take him? And just steer into that, you know, can he get a family and things like that? And then God of War with Kratos making his sort of anger problems like a direct, like, rage meter. And he's sort of, like, freaking out around Atreus. He needs to be a better and actually learn to be a father. And does he know himself if he's worth love? I think all that stuff is just really phenomenal, fertile territory that I absolutely love. And so it was just one of those things where, again, it was one of those games that every single bit of it, the run-up to it, the release of it, the original trailer, the reveal where he steps out the shadow.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Like, one of the best reveals Sony's ever done. And it just followed through perfectly into the game. Like, I just absolutely demolished this game and loved every single second of what they did with his character. So, like, love my time with Ragnarok as well, but the 2018 one is just leagues above because of what it represented.
I think a lot of people would have this in their top 10s.
Bosh.
It's not on mine because I prefer Ragnarok, and that's also not in the top 10. Uh-huh. But I love it for everything. I do love the game for everything that you just referred to there. Mm-hmm. It's the game that got me into God of War, even without having the history with that character. Like you said, that trailer when he emerges from the shadows, it landed with such a thud. Well, no, a thud in a good way.
The crowd does a massive shout.
Yeah, because he's a heavy guy. He's a strong guy. So he landed and made a crater
he's
around
him. He's a
meaty
man.
That's what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. But yeah, for me, God of War 2018 is like the blueprint of how to reinvent a character and a franchise, you know? I know a lot of people might not necessarily love the way the game plays compared to the originals, but as a person, and from a thematic story standpoint, it has so much going on in there. And what a cool way to reckon not only with a character's past, but a franchise's past as well, and what that meant in a gaming space alongside what that character meant in his own in-narrative space. It's juggling a lot. It could have easily not worked, especially with some of the stuff they were trying in terms of the one-take camera that was apparently an absolute nightmare to get right. But they kind of like pulled off the impossible. And that, to me, is like God of War 2018 is the start, for better or worse, maybe, of modern Sony. That's when they really hit a gear, I think. Horizon Zero Dawn was great, but
I would say Last of Us is, because God of War is doing The Last of Us.
I guess
it's all that over-shoulder with a companion. It's all that kind of stuff.
I'll give you that, but there's like, 5 years between God of War and Last of Us? And Last of Us obviously was incredibly instrumental, but I mean, in terms of when they hit the ground running, we had a few false starts in between there, like The Order 1886, the Second Son, and like God of War to me was like, okay, no, this is actually the blueprint.
Oh, totally.
We are looking at The Last of Us, and okay, that's going to be everything we do from now
on. Yeah, because I guess like that's actually funny because, God of War 2018 was in development for 5 years. So I wonder if they literally were like, this has to be our future, because Last of Us was received so well, and it was Naughty Dog.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
But yeah, it's just one of those things where my golden rule is always, what were they trying to do? What did they nail? And they perfectly matured this character and kind of reframed the old games, which is another thing that I love about Uncharted 4. I love the idea of, in that game's case, that franchise's case, reframing the original titles to reinforce how human Drake is, so that it makes every single leap that you do, every single set piece, even more unbelievable that he emerged unscathed. And then in God of War's case, it's just sort of taking all the wanton violence of the 2000s and how the industry used to be. And we used to love like Carmageddon and Manhunt and all these ridiculous over-the-top games, which I still love.
Yeah.
But the idea of addressing that and just being like, okay, if this person actually had been through all this,
yeah,
what would they be like? What would their approach to family life or imparting wisdom, what would that be like? And then steering right into it and fleshing it all out.
And I mean, like, what an era we live in where we have all of these great games about like bad dads and dads trying to be better. Like, it's maybe a narrative point that has been done a little bit too much perhaps over the past few years, but I do think it's still an important point since God of War 2018 came out, and that is, like, you know, how to be a father, like how to avoid a lot of those masculine pitfalls that some people like Kratos definitely get themselves in. Right. How do you connect with this child, and how do you make him not repeat your same mistakes if you can't even talk to the guy, if you can't even, like, acknowledge him as your own or whatever? And, like, that obviously goes into God of War Ragnarok as well, but it starts here, and it's so Fur Island, it's so emotional.
That whole thing that they do, which I think is genius, and there wasn't anything in Ragnarok that got this high in terms of a narrative device, thematic device, of making Atreus, when he realizes he's a god and he kills Magnus and Modi, I think it's Troy Baker and Northern North, the two like brothers, the two gods. And then Atreus realizes he has god powers, and he becomes this like petulant a-hole, and Kratos is the one trying to calm him down and trying to get through to him. I love that as such a reflection on exactly what Kratos was like in the original games. If you go back to those original titles, it's so overlooked how much of a just giant dick Kratos is, especially in God of War 2. Especially in God of War 3. I just think of the beginning of 2 where he's just like, no, like Athena, I've got these powers and whatever. And I love that as just sort of like, how do you make this character reckon with the way, like to realize how far he's come, and for the audience to realize how far he's come. And then for him to have to be better, the whole point of that game, the message towards the end where he just says, you must be better. And it's almost a message to the entire industry, the idea of like portrayals of violence in video games. Or if we're going to do violent stuff, it has to be for something, it has to be better. And I just loved all that stuff. It was just one of those things that resonated with me as someone who grew up with all of that stuff from the beginning all the way through. Your number 8, sir.
Let me check. I was so caught
check
up
the
in
the big old list.
God of War chat that I completely forgot. My number 8 is Mass Effect 1.
And oh, that's such a good show.
I had no idea whether Mass Effect 2 or Mass Effect 1 was going to get onto my top 10 list, but it turns out I love Mass Effect 1, and we've mentioned this before if you want to go back and listen to the podcast that we did when the remastered trilogy came out, but Mass Effect, the original, had such a sense of wonder to it. You know what I mean? Like, you were given this created character called Commander Shepard, and you were essentially set free on this brand new original sci-fi universe. And what a joy it was to explore that in 2007. Oh, being able to travel to different planets, meet a bunch of different alien races, indulge in the lore. Like, I had never seen anything like that before. And in the gaming space, I've never seen anything like that since, where a game franchise comes out with such a confident new world for you to just get lost in. Obviously, it has its inspirations with a bunch of other sci-fi bits of media, but I just don't think I'll ever see that again in the AAA space, man.
The Legacy Edition came out, we all said to each other, like, this is such a reminder of what this used to be and how nothing else is like that. Like, I remember before Mass Effect 1 came out, just being excited to have conversations, because the dialogue tree is still pretty unmatched. Like, in terms of, I mean, obviously there's a weird element of, like, precognition to it, because you are dialing in what your character's going to say before someone's finished their sentence, but it just kind of worked. The timing of it worked. There was enough. You got the idea of the sentiment of the conversation so you could reply properly, and it just kind of replicated an actual conversation, which, like, was mind-blowing for 2007 like, has aged perfectly. I mean, that whole debate, or that whole conversation around which is the best Mass Effect, and it tends to come down to 1v2. Going through the Legacy Edition, or the Legend Edition, whatever the hell they call it, I way preferred Mass Effect 1. Just the tone of it. It's way more open-ended. It's way more Star Trek. It's way more, like, journeying between all these different planets, and, like, just, it just felt grander, and it's like you can pick your... I just like the framing of that story more. I think at the time, I preferred two, but going back through them, one is just this, like, beautiful, open-ended thing.
This is the one that I'll flip-flop on so much, because I love the characters in two. I like the tighter focus of two, and I think it... the way it incorporates your decisions in the final mission is... has more RPG-ness than I think Mass Effect 1. But Mass Effect 1's core framing of there is this alien threat out there and you need to figure out what the hell's going on with it is so memorable. And when you have that conversation with Sovereign towards the end and you understand what the Reapers are, no video game villain has felt more threatening than Sovereign in that moment to me. Like, we are coming, we are going to devour your entire galaxy, and there is nothing you can do about it. The sense of, like, hopelessness, the sense of impending doom that you got with that, again, gave it what you said there, that sense of grandeur, that sense of scale, which is so, you know, unique to a lot of sci-fi properties. And having that as your lead-in to the next game, after you have the attack on the Citadel and you take the Reaper out and you're going up against Saren, who to this day is still an all-timer gaming villain. There's so much going on in that game, and I think it's impressive that, to me, it could do what Bethesda never could, and that was give you... not an open world RPG in this case, but an RPG where your choices matter.
It still felt open as well.
It still felt open. Yeah, absolutely. You still got, like, hub worlds to explore. You got a bunch of different endings. But it gave you a main story that was just as compelling as the side stuff. And it managed to weave them together in an almost perfect way, I thought. And yeah, I don't think there'll ever be a Mass Effect again. Even Mass Effect 4 won't be able to replicate what Mass Effect 1 brought to the table. It's because... like- sorry, just one more thing. Just, it seems so unconcerned with trends from the time as well. Again, I love Mass Effect 2, but you can see where that was inspired by other games. The color scheme completely changes to be more evocative of games at the time. The cover system is, you know, straight out of Gears of War. It's trying to ape that. Mass Effect 1 doesn't even seem concerned with what other people are doing. It's just saying, this is what we want to be. And it's kind of a shame that we never got another one of those.
I wonder if, this is just a sentiment, a statement that my brain served up. I wonder if Mass Effect 1 was the last great BioWare game in terms of the core mentality that BioWare made.
Yeah.
Because, like, I love Mass Effect 2, but you could argue that, like you said, it was the Gears influence, the thing that killed Dead Space 3, chasing trends. Yeah, was Mass Effect 1 the last time BioWare went from beginning to end entirely their own vision? Maybe. It's curious.
It was the last one before they got bought by EA. It could be Mass Effect 2 started off the EA period.
The EA inning.
Dragon Age 2, which, good game, but not as, again, not as ambitious as the original. More scaled down, more tightly focused. Mm-hmm. And while that did work for Mass Effect, didn't quite work for Dragon Age. So yeah, I will think about Mass Effect all the time. Same. I've been thinking about it on and off since 2007. And I was so pleased when the remastered edition came out that it held up and stood the test of time and was still as original and interesting as it always was. There's a few games on this list that might not stand the test of time, but that is one.
Honestly, like the amount of like info that's in the codec stuff. I was just thinking of like the different sort of footprints that Mass Effect has. The audio footprint is one of them. I always think of the music that's on in the menus, the music that's on when you're on the galaxy map. Like it's just it. Final Fantasy, as I'm going through 16 at the minute, is such a reminder of how important audio is and a unique audio footprint for a video game, and not just to have some sort of more generic string section for a AAA game or whatever it is. It's just like Mass Effect had such an identifiable, audible feel.
Yeah.
And you could play just a couple of sound effects over the beginning of one of those pieces of music, and you would instantly remember the entire trilogy or the first couple of games or whatever.
That's it, man.
Like, it was a magical time.
The music, just being able to walk around the Normandy ship, talk to your shipmates, talk to everyone apart from that bad space racist Ashley, you know, keep away from her, but then fall in love with Garrus, fall in love with Rex.
Save Rex.
The
people who let Rex die, I don't know what you're doing.
Please don't let Rex die if you plan on playing the full trilogy. And then, you know, even appreciating other characters the older I get, like, I actually really like Cade now. So sorry for slagging you off for 10 years. I deeply apologize.
I let him die.
Good. Oh, it gets really good in Mass Effect 3. But yeah, like, you know, I think of video games and I think of Shepard opening the galaxy map on the Normandy.
Yes, no, same. I was just thinking of the fact that Caden got so good is at the time it was just, oh, F Caden. That was one of the original like Mass Effect memes or whatever. My number 7 is Halo 2, one of the greatest games of all time.
Halo 2. Fully expected you to have Halo 3 on this list.
2 meant more to me. 2 was the one that was the first one that I went online. It was the first Xbox Live game. Like, Halo 1 was online on PC.
Yeah.
But at the time, like, you know, like, Halo on consoles hadn't been taken online before. So Halo 2 was my introduction to online Halo deathmatches and just everything. Everything that you think of when people talk about online Halo, that was Halo 2. I also love the story. Like, obviously, a lot of people didn't like the way that it ended. I never cared. I was completely fine with that. I didn't expect that to be the end of everything. I always expected it to be a trilogy, at least. And so the whole finishing this fight thing only psyched me up. I thought that was completely fine. I love playing as the Arbiter. I love all the stuff with Chief and the Arbiter. And again, audible footprints, like Halo's music, Halo 2, having that Steve Vai version of the Mjolnir mix. And the main theme, when that kicks in and you have the rocket launcher and you take down the Scarab, gaming rarely gets better than that.
Yeah.
Like, just that whole sequence where you're just running alongside this giant tank in the middle of a city. I think it's in the middle of New Mombasa. Just firing rockets at all the different grunts and the elites that are on that Scarab. As one of the greatest pieces of music ever made plays in the background. Halo 3 could never.
Having been... Well, that's not a sentence. Having played a lot of Final Fantasy 16 now and really appreciating the audio footprint of that game and the music that populates not just the big fights but the more tranquil moments, and having just talked about Mass Effect now, how good of a time was like the mid-2000s for sci-fi games especially in these scores that just went so perfectly together to the point where, like you mentioned there, if you hear the Halo theme now, like, people will be brought down memory lane. They'll be popping big if that drops on a trailer. It just, like I just said there, when I think of gaming, I think of Shepard on the Normandy with the galaxy map. If I say, what is gaming to you to someone else, they'll think of like the Halo 3 reveal trailer. They'll think of that music coming in, you know?
The thing is, that whole period, I mean, it's not taken away from Halo 3. Like, I joked before that Halo 3 could never, only because that moment in Halo 2 was such a big thing, but 3 was monumental as well. Like, that whole trailer, the E3 reveal trailer from 2007, I think it was, or maybe 2006, with Cortana walking out the smoke, is always my favorite trailer from anything. Like, I am splitting hairs between 2 and 3, but if I talk about what meant so much to me, I just always remember getting home with the Steelbook edition of Halo 2, sitting down first level, and when all the grunts are coming in, obviously in the magazines and everything, we'd read that you can dual wield, and so picking up 2 SMGs at the same time, and just standing with double SMGs waiting for the door to open, as the music kicked in, rattling through all of them. It doesn't get better than that, man. Like, Halo 3 was like monumental, it was phenomenal, but 2 was such an escalation.
I'll forever be gutted that I never got to experience Halo multiplayer in its prime.
Right.
We, in our house, didn't get internet, didn't get broadband until 2008, I think. So well late, man. So by that point, Call of Duty 4 had already been out a year, and that was my entrance into online gaming. And to me, not that it was a backstep or anything, but
No, it's still great. It's just very different.
That's it. The progression-based gameplay of Call of Duty 4 felt so different to the more arcadey, open-ended fun of the Halo series that, because I was entrenched in one side, I can never appreciate Halo for what it was, and I'm always so sad that people always talk about these memories of Halo 2 in particular and how much those maps meant to them, how much getting home from school and jumping online meant to them. And I'll never have that, and I feel robbed of it.
Honestly, the whole Halo 2's online, it was just, going on Blood Gulch, making those. And that's the thing. You talk about moments in time. Everyone talked on Xbox Live back then. Obviously, there was some bad stuff in there, but honestly, the majority was great. The majority was coordinating attacks and describing where to go next and just hanging out. People just, oh, where are you from? Okay, cool, I'm from here. I don't know, a bunch of teenagers online, there's going to be some gross stuff, but it just, for most of it, it was so awesome. It was just so solid and communal. And it just, that those original days of Xbox Live, and you could play Splinter Cell Pandora Tomorrow online, where you could talk to the person if you get them in a head hold or whatever. It was all those kind of things. And so, yeah, when I think about my Halo memories, it doesn't get better than Halo 2 personally. That bar or that needle was pinned for quite some time, and 3 is up there, but it's not 2. 2 was life-changing. 2 was unbelievable. Unbelievable.
I always knew you loved 2, but I am actually a little bit surprised by this. I really thought
it's just because of how much.
And
the thing is, as well, you talk about the reveal. They did that trailer that it was the behind closed doors E3 one, and then they put it out. I think it was on video. They put out this collectible. Maybe it was on a disc or something, but they put out this version of the Halo 2 reveal trailer that they did use at E3 in 2003 or whatever it was, set to Hoobastank to the Reason. And that combination of Hoobastank with Halo, it rarely gets better. It was just that whole reveal, and just the fact that Chief can go on and jump on the vehicles, you've got all these different animations and stuff. Nah, man, Halo 2.
You know what's great about Halo 2?
Everything.
Is when you think about it and you look online from the air, the kind of Halo fever that everyone was experiencing at the time. You see people lined up with their Master Chief things to go and buy Halo 2. Obviously, Halo 3 was huge in that regard as well, but that period of people walking out with Xboxes being I have Halo 2.
Dude.
I'm going home to play this right now.
Honestly, the more I think about it, and I was going to do a whole video on this because I can't believe how much Microsoft/Xbox effed it. How much momentum was behind Halo for those first few games. And Bungie even brought it back with Reach. It was a little spin-off game, and that was received incredibly well. And then just to give it to the different team altogether, to change the story altogether, to just continually mess it up, and then have 4 years or 5 years where the Master Chief Collection didn't even work.
Yeah.
Just unbelievable. Really, really unbelievable, considering how perfect those original games were. That's a lot of Halo. What's your number 7?
My number 7 is Silent Hill. Hill 2.
Aha! I was waiting. I was going to be like, is it going to be Silent Hill 3? Silent Hill 1 mean more to him? I don't know.
Silent Hill 1 means a lot to me. That was definitely a contender. That was one of the first video games I ever experienced. I will never forget my dad playing Silent Hill 1 on a stormy night when I was way too young to experience it and being terrified at the opening where you're in the diner and the winged demon crashes through
the
window.
Oh, when you hear it on the radio, static first. Yeah.
Absolutely terrifying, man. So that...
I played that by myself as a kid because I got the demo disc. Nice. And it was when you're a kid, you're just playing through everything. There's no age gating on those demos. So I was playing that myself, terrified when that thing breaks through the window. Yeah.
So when I finally got around to playing it myself years later when I was in university and picked up a PlayStation 1, it was unfinished business. I went back to that game, completed it, and had a great time doing it. But around the same time, because I enjoyed it so much, I thought, well, I might as well get a PlayStation 2 and play Silent Hill 2 and 3. And I'd heard so much about Silent Hill 2, obviously. A lot of people saying it's not only one of the best horror games of all time, but one of the best games of all time, period. So it's another one where I had high expectations. I was coming in during the PlayStation 4 era, playing a PlayStation 2 game, and it still hit. This is not a nostalgia thing for me. This is if you play Silent Hill 2 now, I think you'll still have the time that I had, because I played it well after the fact as well. I just think its sense of place and atmosphere, which we've talked a lot about on this list so far, is impeccable. There's something about those grey PlayStation 2 graphics that works so well for horror.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That kind of emptiness, the sterility of these locations, the fact that the fog can only allow you to see so far ahead of you, probably because the machine couldn't render any further.
I think
than
at that point they were doing it more artistically. Like it was a happy accident with one, but then in two it felt like, especially when you're near the pier, you can see the like the railing sort of like disappear down into the distance kind of thing.
And talk about like that opening, when what a good framing device for a game where you play as a character who's got a letter from their dead wife somehow telling them to go to this spooky town. What a great introduction. The walk into Silent Hill itself, so moody, and figuring out what's going on in Silent Hill takes its time to build, but creates such a strong, unnerving atmosphere. And I'll never forget one of the scares that the game gave me early on, where you're exploring this apartment block, and there's no music stinger to announce that a monster has entered the room. Just because the game sometimes works from static camera angles, it's viewing your camera face on, and it has the doorway just behind him.
Right.
And I just saw this monster walk across the doorframe. And I remember being so unnerved, thinking it was so effective that a game that was old at that point had such this... had such an ability to scare me still.
Honestly,
because it
had
that patience.
We talk about, or we're two of the biggest defenders of like isometric horror, or fixed camera angle horror. Like you can frame scenes in a specific way. I think there is like an art to that stuff.
There is,
and like Silent Hill 2 is one of the masters of it.
Yeah, because it locks you into a perspective. Mm. It makes you see what the game wants you to see, and oftentimes you don't want to see that because you know it's got something scary literally waiting around the corner for you. But yeah. Again, another game with a great audio footprint, the squelches, the industrial noises that are happening while you explore this area. I love that there's barely any combat in the game.
Yeah.
Obviously, there is a little bit. You can whack these monsters to death. I do think you find a gun at some point, but for most of my experience, I was running around them. I was trying to avoid them. I wasn't engaging in it in that way because it's all about the world. It's all about the characters and... the way the story goes with a now well-known and iconic plot twist. It's just such a great self-contained story. And I find it a bit of a shame, as much as I love 1 and 3, that they didn't follow the blueprint of 2, because 3 is a direct sequel to 1 and it kind of builds this lore, whereas 2 is eternal and 2 is iconic because it is self-contained. You can give it to anyone. You don't need 1 to explain it. You can just... it exists on its own terms and... I'm really scared Bloober Team are going to mess it up.
I was just going to say, I think is why they've isolated 2. Obviously, it is by far the most popular one, but then at the same time, it is being given... even the little teaser trailer, obviously, immediately the facial animation's being made fun of and stuff. So whether they can come close to replicating that feel, I don't think so, because I think a lot of that feel is because of the fact that it was made at a certain time. It's very encapsulative of where technology was at the time, and then it's very, like Eastern horror in that style is just so effective. There was such a movement at the time with The Grudge and The Ring, and it's like it's in that bracket for me. Like it's sort of got that, it's doing more with less.
Absolutely. It is doing more with less. It doesn't need so much to scare you. And just like the subtle offness of everyone you interact with, even unintentional things, I assume, like the voice acting and how they probably could have needed a second or third take for some of those line deliveries, works to embody that surreality of Silent Hill as a place, and that kind of nightmare feeling of not knowing if what you're seeing is real. Is it all in the character's head? What's going on? Just a game I could talk about forever, and I'm so pleased, not to brag, that I have the original PS2 copy, the director's cut of the game, because that gets price gouged now. If you want to buy Silent Hill 1 on the PlayStation 1, it's like £70 to £90, and it's about £50 for Silent Hill 2, at least in the UK. It's crazy.
I tell you what, a shout out to the satisfying clicks of using a PlayStation 2 case. Yes. Like either the little slit that was on the edge of the case when you open it, or the little push button thing that not all of them had.
No.
Some of them had the one that would like depress a lot more. I miss PlayStation 2 boxes.
Me too,
I have so many of them.
Get yourself a PlayStation 2. I can't believe you don't own one.
I still got my original one, but it'll be buried in the garage somewhere. Right. But I've got the one from 2001 or whatever, from after 2000, from back in the day. My number 6 and the last one for this podcast this week is Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild.
Nice.
Coming in at number 6. Many Zeldas could have taken this thing's position. I've got such a soft spot for the original one, and I love Ocarina of Time as well. But and Link Between Worlds and Link to the Past, there's a lot of them. There's a lot of them in there. But if I'm going with the one that I was just like quite blown away by, but in a really beautiful way, it is Breath of the Wild. There's such a unique feeling to going through that game. And we talked about it loads. We brought up Breath of the Wild quite a lot, especially when we talked about Tears of the Kingdom. But I just feel like Breath of the Wild is just such a serene, sublime experience. Just play as Link, go vanquish the like evil from the land. If you think you can go straight to the final boss immediately, you can. If you want more time to explore and figure out more abilities that Link actually has that you don't realize as the player. I just love that metatextual thing of becoming the hero or remembering how to be the hero. And I feel like that is just a really great way of doing a Legend of Zelda. I also love the approach to puzzles. A lot of people didn't like getting rid of the dungeons and then having the shrines instead. I'm a huge fan of that. I like having the bite-sized approach to it because it fit perfectly with the Switch.
Yeah.
And so obviously when it tied into when that console launched in 2017, just doing a few puzzle shrines on the way to work or on the way back or sitting on the toilet or whatever. I like that whole thing. And it's like you could spend 30 hours in it or 30 minutes or whatever and get nice little morsels of stuff. I personally think it's head and shoulders above Tears of the Kingdom, but I get why people don't. Obviously, Tears of the Kingdom builds on it quite a lot, but if I'm talking about the feeling of something when I first played through it,
yes.
Breath of the Wild is near unmatched.
We have been talking about Breath of the Wild lots over the past few weeks because we've been talking about Tears of the Kingdom.
Horrible.
Don't tell me it was 6 years ago. I don't need to know that. And like we keep mentioning, and like you mentioned there, like I don't think you'll have another Breath of the Wild like it. It was such a moment in time. It was so new. It was so fresh. It completely transformed how we approached open world games and certainly how we approached Zelda games. And while it's not another one that's not on my list but would be in my top 20, like that is one of the happiest I've ever been. I remember being, I've told this story before, but just being back in my parents' house after the first time I'd been away from them for like a long period of time, like a full year not seeing them, playing Breath of the Wild on a handheld, which was so unlike me at the time, on their couch while life was happening around me, 6 or 7 hour stints a day, getting lost in Hyrule into this new world that I wasn't familiar with because I had no idea about anything Zelda related. Didn't know the characters were, or the character archetypes were repeated across games. I thought they were all unique to Breath of the Wild, which was a surprise when I played Skyward Sword and realized that wasn't the case. I think if you had this as number one, I'd say, yeah, that makes sense.
It's one of those things where I think, we'll get into my 5-1 next week, but where at this point we're talking about we are splitting the hairs of the molecules of the hairs to make these different distinctions between different games. But yeah, for me, it was just everyone knows why Breath of the Wild is a big deal, but it meant quadruply as much back in 2017 just because of the competition it was up against and how formulaic and boring the open world genre had gotten and how many conversations were doing in the rounds across that year of, you know, is the industry losing its way? Are we giving too much into microtransactions? You know, that was the year of Battlefront 2, Shadow of War, and For Honor, which were just loaded with monetization.
Yeah.
And then here was Nintendo just going like, here's just a game, just a reminder that a game doesn't need a checklist of things to do. It's just an experience, and it's like, you know, there's verticality to it. It's about a 3D space. It's just a video game. Like, just play it.
Honestly, it kind of broke open world games for me for this next 6 years, because not just because of the reasons you mentioned there about you don't need a checklist of stuff to do, follow your nose, like just go out and explore and see what you find, but also the interactivity of the world itself. After playing Breath of the Wild and using my brain and everything in the environment to navigate that environment, it just made other open world games feel so sterile and artificial and like I was playing around in a static toy box where I didn't have any influence over the environment itself. I was just getting funneled down these really beautiful sandboxes that I couldn't actually manipulate because everything you can manipulate everything in Breath of the Wild, and it makes for some incredibly memorable moments, but incredibly satisfying moments of ingenuity where you feel like a genius because you've figured out a solution and you're not sure if that solution is what the developers wanted,
that
but
whole thing.
It worked.
Yeah, that whole thing of like the way the physics work in it, where it's, oh, better if I pick up a leaf, I can waft a sail and blow myself across the wind, across the water or whatever. Blow myself, I said. And like something like that, or like the fact that you can just, if there's an open flame next to some meat, it'll cook it or whatever. Yeah, Breath of the Wild is my number six. Oh, what is yours?
My number six is The Last of Us Part 2.
Shout!
It's on here. The Last of Us Part 1 isn't, but it would, again, be in my top 20. So
Last of Us is in my top 5.
Is it?
Yes.
I'll throw that in as a caveat. If you're a long-time listener of this podcast and channel, you'll know I love The Last of Us Part 2. I bang about it. Or bang on about it all the time. But the reason that it's the reason that it has stayed one of my favorites of all time is its exploration of grief. And I think that's going to get even more pronounced the older I get. Because the older I get, the more grief I experience, the more people I lose, the more people who pass away, the more funerals I go to. And I cannot overstate how well, especially the opening hours of The Last of Us 2, captures that sense of loss and grief and the conflicting emotions that you have around that. And the fact that that's in a AAA video game that has incredible combat, in my opinion, and these mad plot twists, to me is kind of a minor miracle. I personally, and I'm sure there are other great games out there, I have played good games about grief, not seen it kind of explored in such a potent way before, in terms of how Ellie kind of longs for this person that she will never see again. All of the unspoken things that she wishes she could have said, all of the things that she now won't be able to do, things that she views she's been outright robbed of. That sense of regret that tinges The Last of Us Part 2, like I said, is so potent and resonates so much with me that it will forever be a favorite game of mine, I think, forever. It was initially the number two spot on here, but I've knocked it down a little bit. But I can only see it, honestly, growing as time goes on, unless they somehow manage to reverse it with The Last of Us Part 3. But I don't think they will,
I don't
because
think
this
so.
Still works.
I think Last of Us Part 2 will only age better and better and better. I think it was the, obviously, to some portions of the internet, it was the victim of some of the leaks that happened, but then to everyone else who just went through it, maybe it wasn't the sequel that you wanted. That's where I come down. Like, it's still beautifully made, and I can talk about it for hours and hours and hours. I just prefer the original one. Overall, but we'll get to that next week. I think for Last of Us Part 2, like you said, there are so many mature themes in there and they are handled so well. I think for me, it's the fury that comes out of grief, like the sort of like this, just the F the world, what's even the point side of it. Which, like you said, as you get older, you experience a lot more of that. And it's just like the fact that they, the way that they've like rolled that in with Ellie's overall motivation, that she's trying to do right by Joel, but she is sort of acting out. She is kind of like taken over by the aggression side of it, and she's trying to like use all these lessons that Joel has taught her. You know, and then the way that that game ends, all the stuff that happens with Dina and everything, and obviously there's all the stuff with Abby as well. It's a whole other thing. Last of Us 2 was like thoroughly, thoroughly impressive to me. I like absolutely loved my time with it. It was just that when I hit the credits, I was like,
I
don't know if that's what I wanted from Last of Us 2, but like, I'm glad you guys did it.
It's funny, it wasn't initially what I wanted from the game, but it blindsided me so much, but in a good way, because I couldn't believe the story they were telling, and just the way that Ellie's kind of entire motivation hinges around on, like I said, what she was robbed of. Her final conversation with Joel, like, gets me in tears every time, because it's the promise of a future that she'll never have.
Yeah.
And how much the lack of that future, it just impacts her, is so relatable. But even away from the themes and the story of The Last of Us, I just think it plays really well.
It does
well.
Play really well.
It's honestly maybe my favorite playing third-person shooter ever.
What about Resident Evil 4 Remake?
Nah, this is better, man. This is better. There's something about the heft to it. There's something about the weight to it. It's Max Payne 3 on steroids, I think. There's a sense of grittiness to it. There's a sense of griminess to it, to the point where, I returned to it for the story, of course, but I could just play those combat and
I just reloaded those over and over and over and over again. I love that we talked about slow motion before. I love the slow motion toggles because it lets you drink in just how unbelievably incredible Naughty Dog's animation department is. I agree with you. Like, I feel like they do have like sort of like leaden kind of weightier combat, but it's not, it's what Rockstar kind of are trying to get to kind of thing. I feel like it's a, if you took a Red Dead 2 and refined it even more, it's Last of Us 2. I love that they maintain responsiveness. It's always the thing that annoys me about most games. If I'm pushing the button, I want to be able to do it. And in The Last of Us 2, they always find a way to like segue that animation into a dodge or into like a go, but like slide through part of the environment or something else. You can chain everything together.
That's it.
It's so fluid.
It's so fluid, and it's the only game. A lot of games have tried to evoke a sense of scrappiness, a sense that you're surviving in the world, that you're improvising in the world, but no game has done it as effectively as The Last of Us Part 2 for me, in the way that you are, you know, you're picking up this bottle, you're throwing it, you're using your last round of your rifle to headshot the last enemy just before they manage to get a shot on you. That sense of you are just scraping through every combat encounter, no matter what difficulty you're playing on, is so pervasive, and of course adds to the themes, but just feels so good to play in and of itself. It's why I really am looking forward to The Last of Us multiplayer game, because that core framework, I could play for hours and hours and hours.
The idea of like, because yeah, that scrappiness is a really good name for it. I forget exactly where the level is in 2. I think it's when you meet the Seraphites, but there's like that bit where it's a collapsed like multi-story car park.
Yes.
Or like a collapsed highway, and you're sort of making your way up that. And you can play the angles game quite nicely and dodge behind all these different cars and throw these different distraction items out and things like that. And like you said, it's like you've maybe run out of ammo if you're on a higher difficulty, but you still have your knife and you can still get a couple of hits in. If you just ambush someone at the right time and you are thinking in the way that those people would be thinking to get through that scenario, and it just walks that line so well.
That's it. I have no idea the magic they use for the AI system, but it feels like incredibly human, or you know, obviously not human, but the most responsive and smart that I've experienced in a third-person shooter, where it does feel like I'm having to outthink them. You know, obviously there are times where it breaks and someone will just run at you while you've got a shotgun pointed at their face, but
that person might have done that anyway.
Maybe. For the most part, I do think it works and keeps you on your toes, thinking two steps ahead, like you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And you also just mentioned the levels, which Seattle as a place is one of my favorite video game settings. How wet that place feels and how stodgy it feels. I don't know what magic they were doing with the PlayStation controller, but every time it rains in that game and Ellie's got a hood up, you can feel like the pitter-patter of it. It really feels like you're getting drenched, which is so strange, and I don't know how they pulled it off. But yeah, Seattle being destroyed, being flooded. I love that setting. It's kind of almost mythical. It's larger than life. It feels exaggerated, but it somehow works.
For me, it's the my favorite bit of it is right towards the end. It's sort of like, for me, that whole game, like there are the themes of grief, but I feel like the bigger thing I took away from it was just this wider sort of commentary on like on hate, like whether it's industrialized hate or like sort of whether it's through like a military system, whether it's through religion or just whatever, like the idea that we just cannot seem to just get on. Like there's a Rise Against song called The Violence about like, are we just predisposed to this? Like, is there no way that we can ever just sort of make amends and carry on? Dirty centrist over here doing this. but that's one of the things. And so, towards the end of Last of Us 2, when everything is burning and it's just like, look how much effort was put into this encampment. It's now just all going up in flames and how apocalyptic that all looks.
Yeah.
And their framing of human on human violence at the very end, Ellie versus Abby. That was the stuff that really, I was in bits by the end of Last of Us 2, but it was partly because of how much Ellie had been through and Abby, but then also just that commentary on just the ability or the lack of the ability that we have to just get on with each other.
Well, like Disco Elysium called me, the big commie in me also, loves that kind of, that entire approach to, like you said, those cycles of violence, which I know being talked about so much, but the way that's kind of like summed up with what you mentioned there, there's another Idols song, funnily enough, where it's like fear leads to anger leads to hate, hate leads to
that was Yoda.
Whatever and stuff. It also was Yoda. He said that in The Phantom Menace. And you know what? He wasn't wrong there either. But the way that naturally progresses and Ellie's looking for someone to take her anger and hatred out on that she views as just, but then you see that other side and they have just like an equal amount of claim to what they were doing with just because they were hurt in the exact same way. And it's like, well, where do we meet in the middle? How do we get over this? All of that stuff, I think it's really good.
I also think it's really good. Do you know what else is really good?
What?
Is the wind-up. This has been our first half of the greatest games of all time. 10 through 6 for me is Assassin's Creed 2, The Elder Scrolls 5, Skyrim, God of War 2018, Halo 2, and Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild.
What a list. For mine, 10 to 6 is Call of Duty Warzone at 10, Disco Elysium at 9, Mass Effect at 8, Silent Hill 2 at 7, and The Last of Us Part 2 at 6. And look, I don't want to blow my own trumpet, but I think my top 5, there's some good games in there, is what I want to say.
There should be. Stay out of the house, number one. I feel like overall, it's fun going back through our entire lives worth of video games. But join us next week where both of us will go through our 5-1 and see what our favorite games of all time each are. And for now, this has been The Wind-Up. I've been Scott Tilford. That's been Josh Brown.
Always a pleasure, Scott Tilford. And right now, before we get into the proper outro of this, I'm going to make a guess.
This is the outro.
It is. But I'm going to guess right now. We can fade this out. Your number one is going to be Metal Gear Solid 1. Don't tell me. That's my guess for next week.
I'll catch you all next week.
See you later.
Bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.